Hi, I'll be brief since I have 15 minutes, but there seems like there's lots of people that know lots of things about all my favorite things, so I'm excited to be here. Thanks for having me. So I've been doing these studies on how musicians improvise together, and thank you. That was a really easy solution to my problem. So I'm running these experiments, and after I work with these musicians, I interview them, and so I'm going to read a quote from one of the musicians talking about his experience improvising. Because a lot of the times it's just like parallel trains, not necessarily paying any attention to each other until something happens, and it's usually by accident, and that will change the whole direction. And then also there's someone I've begun collaborating that's at Ohio State University now, Andreas Scavio, and he has done a similar method interviewing a string quartet, and so this is not—they're not necessarily improvising, but they're still describing similar dynamics. So you need a smooth development, and therefore each tone, each and every vibrato, each and every oscillation, bowing, phrasing, everything builds towards how it's going to become, and is impossible to predict how it will play out. So I've become really interested in these transitions that happen when musicians are improvising, and so I'll show you the method that I designed to sort of explore this phenomenon. So I worked with six pairs of professional piano players. They had a range of 10 to 35 years of training in piano performance and 5 to 30 years of experience with improvisation, so a really wide range. And the manipulations, we were interested in how the dynamics change when you have a different backing track, so when they're improvising in a different musical context. So the first backing track is the introduction to a swing jazz standard called There's No Greater Love. This was used in a study by Peter Keller. And this is what it sounds like. So it's like the beginning sort of played as a bass line. And this is repeated throughout the trial, which is about 2.5 minutes. And then the second backing track, it's a little different. It's just a repeated melodic phrase. It's actually in 7/8 time. And this is what it sounds like. So it's sort of in the middle octave, takes up a different space musically, and the time signature is different. And the third is just a drone, so not necessarily any musical structure, just a tone, and no reference to a genre of performance that they might be familiar with as jazz musicians. I don't know if you can hear that. Okay. And then we manipulated the availability of visual information about their co-improviser, so we put a curtain in between them, and part of the time the curtain wasn't there. And so they came in, they sort of got used to the context, they improvised individually with the tracks just to sort of get familiar, and then we had pair trials where they improvised together. And so we manipulated, they did conditions with the visual information, no visual information, the different backing tracks, and they did each of them twice for a total of 12 trials that lasted 2.5 minutes. And this is sort of what the experimental setup looks like. So they're facing each other. We had to make PVC pipe keyboard stands because the motion tracking system is magnetic. And they're standing, which is definitely different than normal performance context. But so what we're capturing here, we're measuring the notes they're playing using the MIDI. So we're using Ableton to record the MIDI notes. And we are also recording their body movements. So they have a sensor attached to their forehead, one to their left forearm and one to their right forearm. We also have video for global coordination, but haven't looked at that quite yet. And then I read you a quote from one of the post-session interviews. And so in these interviews, they're actually watching the videos of them improvising and sort of giving their account of the experience. But I won't go into that today. And to give you an idea of what this looks like, so they could play whatever they wanted. This is over the drone if you can't hear it. As you can see, we've got the sensors here. The backing track plays for about 2.5 minutes. It fades, and they have to sort of resolve it together. I'm sorry, what? Yeah, so what's nice is you can't really tell. We did that intentionally, so in the post interviews. But I think this one, there's no curtain because I used those blue ribbons to tie back the curtain. Yeah, so this is the yeah, so how to measure this? They can play whatever they want. And so there's not a musical score. There's no like ideal state that these musicians as a system should be in. They have a continuous flow of information about their co-improviser, whether or not it's visual or non-visual. They have lots of different information they can couple with. And especially the movements are aperiodic. They're non-stationary. And so but what we do a lot of at University of Cincinnati is complex dynamical systems. And so what these are statistical tools that don't assume stationarity of a time series. And so they allow us to look at these this spontaneous coordination patterns in both the movement and the musical structure. And I'll show you some ways I came up with that. But I wanted to play, so I've been focusing a lot on the transition, so how these musicians are coupled through the transitioning into different musical states. And so I want to play an example of what I mean by that. And so there won't be any visual, just listen to it. Just sort of like atonal. This is to the drone also. And you can see one of them repeated the other. And they end in this like bedtime twinkly kind of sound. It's really nice. Yeah, so what I've been trying to do is explore how that the coupling is changing or what is not changing about the coupling as they're making those transitions and creating something new. So there's a lot of nonlinear analyses that I could use. I think my abstract mentions cross-wavelet spectral analysis. We wrote a paper about this for Frontiers in Theoretical Psychology. So what that does, it allows you to look at movement coordination at multiple time scales between two movement time series. There's also fractal analysis, so that lets you capture the complexity of a system. And so when you put different constraints on it, for example, the backing track, you can see how that complexity changes. There's recurrence analysis, so I've been using this to see when the musicians are visiting the same musical states throughout the trial. And then, actually, this is a linear analysis, principal component analysis. I've been using that to evaluate dimensional compression. So if the musicians are acting as a system, are we seeing dimensional compression in their movements? So if you want to talk about any of these, I'd love to. I ran all of these studies, but I'm just going to talk about the last two, recurrence analysis and principal component analysis today. There's this main effect of backing track I just want to walk through and sort of scale up the ways that you can quantify this coupling. So you can look at the notes, and so that would be what you consider more of a semantic level of the interaction. And then we sort of scale up to key press timing, so just the patterns of when they're pressing the keys, not necessarily which keys they're pressing. And then I'm going to take a big jump into like all of the movement of their full body movements of both the musicians using principal component analysis. And so again, look at the main effect of backing track across these different levels of coupling. So the first analysis I'm going to present is cross-recurrence analysis I did on the MIDI notes. So I have the MIDI time series, and so there's what they're playing, which key they're playing at each time point in the trial. And so I have the number of the key. And then I create a code number that represents any unique combination of keys. So this is not based on any music theory. They could kind of be playing whatever they want for the swing. Obviously, I have ways to guess, but to you look across all backing tracks, just any unique combination of keys, any number. And then I take that time series, and I put in random numbers so it doesn't come up as a recurrent state. And then I take the notes of the second player, and you can create what's a cross-recurrence plot to show when they're repeating the same note structures as well as when they're repeating them at different delays. And so this is what the cross-recurrence plot looks like, and you can quantify these plots using measures like maxline. So maxline is used to sort of index the stability of coordination, so it's the longest sequence of repeated note structures that you would see in this instance. And so you would take these recurrence plots and you would quantify them, and so I'll show you the results for the maxline for how much the musicians repeated each other's note structures. And so there were no significant effects for the note structures. It kind of makes sense. They wouldn't really be repeating each other exactly. And this is pretty strict analysis. There was a main effect when you looked at just when they're repeating their own notes, in case you're wondering why I'm presenting a non-significant result. But we'll move forward. So the node structures, there wasn't any significant difference. It doesn't seem to be capturing the coupling. So we'll move to key press timing. So this is the same analysis, except for there are no code numbers representing which keys they press. You just replace all of them with one if they're playing a key, and then a random number if they're not, so that doesn't count as a recurrent point. And you can see in the plot there are a lot more recurrent points because it's just getting the patterns of when they're pressing the keys. And so you take this plot and you quantify it to see how much they repeat each other's key press timing. And so here we are seeing a significant effect. So when the musicians were playing with the swing track, they were significantly, they were repeating each other's key press timing significantly less. And so I'll move forward to principal component analysis, looking at the dimensional compression and their body movements. So for those of you not familiar with PCA, it looks at the covariation between the dimensionality and a data set. And so you submit variables, and it'll tell you if you can get rid of some of those variables based upon how they change in a similar way. So for my data, I have the time series of their head, right arm, and left arm in both the X, Y, Z dimension. And so I run the principal component analysis on these 18 variables, so the system has 18 degrees of freedom. And then principal component analysis will tell me if I get some dimensional compression considering them as a full system. And so we used it to determine how many components were required to capture the variance in all these movements. And so in these results, if there are less components, it means there's more dimensional compression. So fewer components could account for the variability in that data. And more components would equal less dimensional compression. So these are results. So what's interesting is for that same swing track, there were more components needed to account for the variance in their body movements, meaning that there was less dimensional compression when they were playing with the swing track. So what's cool about like using all these different analyses to look at coupling at the different levels is that you can compare these results. So, so there wasn't any difference in the node structure, but they're repeating their key press timing significantly less. And so you're also seeing an effect for the body movements that you need more principal components to account for that movement. So there's more variability in their key press timing, and you're seeing that variability needing more components to capture that variability in the actual movement. And so the head is in there, but still, when you consider the whole system, these things are sort of related at these different levels. You can identify all these patterns, but you don't really know what they mean for actually, like, what are the optimal dynamics of the system? Does that, if they have a certain pattern of coordination, does it mean that they're producing better music? And so I was having listeners just evaluated on different qualities, how much they enjoy it, emotional, like a conversation. But what I've been doing now is having listeners, we sort of have rigged up this Arduino knob, and listeners, as they listen, they turn this knob according to how they think the quality of the music is changing as they're listening. And so what we can do is they're listening to the audio, and they're turning it. We give them different keywords for different trials. And so we can identify in the velocity profiles of them turning this knob when these transitions are happening, or how listeners are perceiving these transitions as happening in the music. And so we can then identify those transition points, and then look at how this coupling is shifting at those transition points. Because what I just showed you is just averaged across trial for all these measures. But as we sort of understand the way that the listener's experience of the music is changing, we can identify those points where we can understand how are they negotiating with each other at all this different type of informational coupling. How is that changing when they're transitioning to a new musical state? And so this is a drawing I made a long time ago before I ran the study, and I feel like I ended up with this, like, a huge mess of data and information and trying to find patterns. So hopefully it seems like I've done that today. Thank you.